flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is 9:19, Wednesday, October 27th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And to any of my Knicks fans out there on their 3-1 start, I got two words for you. Bing bong.
Hi, good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. No snotty comments today about the Boston Red Sox. They had a remarkable season, made it to the ALCS. John Green, your team never gets anywhere. It's just a lost cause. So I don't want to hear it, pal.
You just keep telling yourself and your therapist that, Bill Finley. That'll get you to sleep at night. John Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And guys, you don't realize this, but this afternoon, after I'm done with the show, I have been asked to be a premier speaker for the North Dakota Veterinary Department. None other than our beloved Skip Anderson is actually a professor at North Dakota, and he has asked me to impart wisdom and advice on the young minds of the livestock industry this afternoon. What could go wrong?
Congratulations. I thought you only got invited to Mr. Peanut conventions when you were in your
Mr. Peanut conventions. You know, I do have to wear my monocle today. That was a pre-requirement. But, you know, listen, with all sincerity, I mean, you know, we've all won, you know, big awards and given presentations and speeches and everything like that. I am so looking forward to this one this afternoon. There's going to be like 30 or 40 students and other professors from North Dakota who are going to be listening to the Zoom call. I'm giddy and I'm a little nervous, to be honest with you.
Well, that's why that's what this show is for, to loosen you up, to talk to the youth of tomorrow. God help them.
Exactly.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The Keeneland Fall Meet continues through this Saturday, October 30th. New Keeneland Select accounts receive a special $100 back after you wager $200 on Keeneland Racing this fall. You can wager a total of $300 and earn another $100 back. You can visit KeenelandSelect.com to sign up. And also a reminder that the Keeneland November sale is right around the corner. Starts November 10th, runs through November 19th. November 19th is the new one-day Horses of Racing Age portion. I know John's perusing that as well. So very excited for the Keeneland November. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of action, you know, relative to the Breeders' Cup horses. You always see some of those beautiful mares show up a couple days after the Breeders' Cup, and there's always a huge appetite for them. And then the Horses of Racing Age sale, I think, actually adds a lot of juice to the end of the sale. I think when most people might have been out of town by then, I think a lot of people will stick around for that and, you know, look for 2022 racing prospects.
Yep. And Joe, the other thing it does is they used to have it set up where there was like a dozen to 20 horses of racing age at the end of each day. And now by making it one dedicated day, it makes it so much easier for trainers and owners to just focus on horses of racing age. I think it was a brilliant decision and a very strategic one by Keeneland.
This is going to be kind of a light show. We have a little bit of a lull right now in terms of news and racing before the Breeders' Cup. And then, of course, the Breeders' Cup pre-entries come out later today. And then next week, we'll have all the fields and all the post positions. We'll do a huge Breeders' Cup show, possibly back in the studio. But today's going to be a little bit of a light show. But there was some news last week that this broke, I think, earlier this week or last week, with friend of the show, John Cherwa, in the Los Angeles Times. He got the information on what the Bob Baffert extra scrutiny and extra security is actually going to entail in the Breeders' Cup. So basically, there's going to be investigators assigned exclusively to Bob Baffert's barn who are going to monitor it on a 24-hour basis and be allowed to confiscate medications and ointments and review daily treatment and billing records. We don't know how many horses Baffert is going to enter in the Breeders' Cup thus far. So far, it looks like Medina Spirit, Private Mission, Corniche, Grace Adler, and Gamine, which is pretty small number for Bob Baffert. Usually, he would have a lot more horses for the Breeders' Cup. But this is going to be an interesting subplot, I think, to the Breeders' Cup, just to see how Bob Baffert's horses run. Because if you read the story also, they're going to have access to veterinary records going back 60 days. They're going to have access to Santa Anita surveillance going back to mid-October. So this is actually, you know, I didn't know how different it was going to be for Baffert as opposed to other horses. There's also going to be security guards, one security guard per horse in the Bob Baffert barn. at the Breeders' Cup. So they really are kind of, you know, drilling down on him a little bit. And he's, of course, saying the right things, that he's, you know, he's happy to comply with all this. We're just going to take care of the horses as usual. It's a quote from the story. It says the Breeders' Cup has in place a team of 2 investigators, 3 security officers, and a Breeders' Cup executive to watch Baffert's barn on a 24-hour basis until the horses are shipped to Del Mar in the coming days. Once the horses are moved, a security officer will be assigned to each of Baffert's horses and will be equipped with body cameras. That's real police work right there. It doesn't stop police from doing things they shouldn't do, but the concept of body cameras is one of transparency. And it says normally body cams are not used and a single security officer watches 2 or 3 horses. On November 2nd, blood, urine, and hair samples will be taken on all of Baffert's prospective Breeders' Cup runners to be followed by random collection during the week. Baffert has agreed to scratch any horse that tests positive for illegal but controlled medication, even if it falls within the window for legal use. So they're basically saying you can't even use the drugs that you would normally use, even if it's, you know, within the right window for usage. So they really are kind of giving him separate rules from other trainers, which, you know, you could say, you could debate whether or not that's actually fair. But I think he kind of set himself up for this with what happened this year and what's happened in the past couple of years specifically. It's a lot of information. I'm glad that we at least got the details because it was very vague when the first announcement came out from the Breeders' Cup. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, I mean, this is a good thing. And, you know, it's going above and beyond. You know, when you talk about body cameras and that sort of thing and round the clock surveillance, you know, not that Baffert would try anything. I'm not insinuating that, but it would be impossible. Absolutely impossible to try to do anything to improve a horse through medications. So, you know, it is good. And remember, too, he's got to pay for this. And, you know, this is not going to be cheap. Now, I'm sure Bob Baffert has plenty of money, but, you know, this has got to get into the tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands of dollars to, you know, hire all these people. The one thing that I don't quite understand, we were on the show last week and we were saying that, well, what's the big deal here? That they just said we're going to have a lot of scrutiny and we're going to do out of competition testing. And, you know, what does the scrutiny mean that they hire Barney Fife to watch your barn? I don't know why they didn't say this right from the start, because it left most of us saying, well, how is this any different than what even John Green said? My horses get this exact same sort of treatment. So I thought it was just a little odd that the Breeders' Cup, you know, wasn't, you know, more transparent right from the beginning that this is what they were going to do, especially when it would likely be perceived by everybody as a positive. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be easy on Baffert. It's going to be a big inconvenience. But like you said, he brought it all on himself.
He brought it all on himself. It's well deserved. And now, you know, if his horses run well with all of this additional scrutiny, then I think it kind of opens things up for discussion as far as, well, you know, was it really bad management or was it that he was, you know, doing illicit and illegal things on the horses? You know, I think this will help clear the air a little bit with all of this. Bill, I concur. I wish that the Breeders' Cup would have announced this last week as far as what the scrutiny was, because I'm sure at that time they'd already agreed upon it, which is why they made the announcement. So they must have, you know, fleshed out the details to this extent, which are much, you know, greater than what we would have to do. So last week I came on and said, yeah, our horses are doing the exact same, because the way they set it up, it was like, well, it sounds pretty much what we have to do with our horses as well. But I'm glad that they're doing this additional scrutiny. Now, the other thing that it does, and I think Baffert Legal Counsel Walt Robertson was interested in this part, you know, now that they're going to have 24-hour security and you know, watching over the horses and everything like that, it also gives him another legal defense if something comes up positive. It was obviously the Breeders' Cup official that was wearing the Salon Paws patch and the investigator and the security officers that peed in the stall. So, you know, it was really a brilliant legal defense in advance by Walt Robertson et al. To try to make sure that they had additional excuses just in case.
John, I want to bring up, but do you think that his horses are going to run, not show up? He's not going to have a good performance because of all this extra security? I don't, not even for a minute.
No, you know, and Bill, you know, you tongue in cheek before said Barney Fife, you know, kind of watching the barn. And I know from being at the Breeders' Cup and being, you know, at Kentucky Derby, when they actually brought in deputies from the respective municipalities, you know, to come in and watch the horses and watch the stalls. And I can tell you, they were great guys. They had long and established careers, you know, in law enforcement, which I totally respect. But they wouldn't know, the same as the majority of the population wouldn't know, if a veterinarian was going in and giving an injection of Lasix or giving an injection of something that was illegal, because that's beyond their scope and you can't ask them to do that. So, you know, so I think that that's a little, you know, that's a little unfair. And I can tell you also, and you know, from speaking to a couple of people, like, once you get to the backstretch of any racetrack, it's very easy, especially like a couple of weeks before the Breeders' Cup or a couple of weeks before the Derby and the Oaks, it's very easy to walk around and like give sugar cubes or carrots to horses, you know, and walk into somebody's barn and pet noses. And even if you wanted to pee in the back of the stall, not that I, you know, would recommend that. It's very easy. It's very lax as far as the security. So if we're talking about, you know, the scrutiny of horses coming to California and Santa Anita to run in the Breeders' Cup, they're coming from somewhere, and they're usually coming from somewhere, you know, just maybe 10 days or so, or maybe a week in advance, because there are some horses that right now are on the cusp of getting in or not getting drawn in to the entries. So they don't know. So they're probably training at their home, respective home tracks. Well, if the security there is lax, then what's to say that things didn't happen there and then they brought the horse over and that's why it tested positive. So I think this is definitely a step in the right direction. Don't get me wrong. I am all in favor of what the Breeders' Cup is recommending and what they're implementing with regard to Bob Baffert, because he's earned this distinction now. He's earned this additional amount of scrutiny. And if he's willing to accept it, then I also see no problem in allowing the horses to run. But there's also other things that are being done, you know, previous to that. And I guess you just have to draw a line in the timeline and say, okay, when is it too much? When is enough enough? You know, do we enforce that all the horses have to train at the respective track, you know, up to 4 weeks in advance? I don't know if they can actually do that or not, especially because they just don't know if certain horses are going to get in.
I have a lot to follow up on. That might have been the longest I've got on this show without talking. several points. First of which is, John is very obsessed with the pissing in the stall thing. He brings that up a lot.
It's just, I don't understand it. There's bathrooms at every other barn. I just, it boggles my mind. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry, Jeff.
Yeah. There's something there. I think the horses will probably run okay, because, you know, when we were talking about the betamethasone positive and all, you know, the lidocaine stuff and these, you know, kind of barely over the threshold drug positives, I don't think any of us really thought that Medina Spirit won the Derby because of the betamethasone positive, or Gamine ran, you know, Gamine tested positive when she ran like a pretty bad third in the Oaks. I don't think that, you know, this, the stuff that they're testing for at least, is, you know, necessarily going to make the difference in the horse running first or running last. I think his horses will run basically on par, but it will be a big story if his horses do run up the track and Gamine stinks it up at 3-5 or something like that. That, I think, will be a huge, huge story. It'll be a small sample size, but I think it'll be a big enough sample size that you can draw at least a little bit of a conclusion from it. The other thing is, you know, if his horses do run well, I think that this gives him kind of a defense in the Naira situation, you know, because he can turn around and say, I'm complying with all of this additional scrutiny that basically no trainer in the history of racing has ever had to deal with at the Breeders' Cup. And look, my horses still ran fine. You know, what grounds do you have to say that, like, I'm, you know, putting my horses in danger and you know, putting the integrity of the sport on the line, you know, just because of a couple of minor overages? Now, I don't know that I would necessarily agree with that, but, you know, if they do run well and nobody tests positive, he doesn't have to scratch anybody, I think that gives them a little bit of a leg to stand on in the whole Naira hearing process. And the other thing is, I think it is a significant outlay for him to be paying for all of this security and all of this surveillance. So maybe fewer billable hours for Craig Robertson. I think he could maybe shift some of those funds from Craig Robertson's coffers into paying for this, because God knows he's paid that guy a lot of money this year. to really just kind of delay Naira's suspension. I think that's basically all that Craig Robertson accomplished. But yeah, so I mean, it's a good kind of proactive thing by the Breeders' Cup. They were put in a tough position with everything that's gone on this year. They couldn't not let his horses run. This is probably the best they could do. And I got to say, at least good on Bob Baffert for not making a stink about it, because that was one of the things that, you know, really, I think, pissed a lot of people off when the Dina Spirit thing first came out, was the constant whining about cancel culture and, you know, all the excuses. At least this time he's saying, let's go, let's do the damn thing. Let the horses run, let the chips fall where they may, and we're going to see how they do.
Yep. And Joe, not to stick up for his poor owners, but I think that the bill will get passed across the table to the owners that are represented, that own the horses. I don't think Bob Baffert is going to be out dollar one out of this situation, because if the owners are willing to stick with Bob Baffert throughout all this, I'm sure they also, you know, no pun intended, ponied up and say, yeah, we'll pay for this just to, you know, to prove his innocence. I don't think BB is out one penny on this additional scrutiny.
That's definitely possible. Just to transition here, there's another trainer that has been given some kind of relief and able to run. Yesterday, the Louisiana State Racing Commission unanimously passed a motion that owner and trainer Carl Broberg believes will allow him to race horses at the upcoming fairgrounds meet, despite an exclusion order imposed last month by that track's owner, Churchill Downs Incorporated. I know Bill has some thoughts on this, so I'm going to toss it to him, and then we can bounce ideas off of each other.
Yeah, well, a little bit more about the story. If you remember, allegedly Broberg had a horse after a race who was lame, and Churchill said that, and this was at Churchill Downs, they had said that there was nobody there to care for the horse. It was just sort of left to its own devices. And, you know, it became Broberg disputed this. It became a he said type of thing. But they did exclude him. And it would include all their racetracks. Of course, Churchill Downs owns the fairgrounds as well. What is interesting to me on this is that, you know, we talk a lot about, and this has to go back to the Baffert, do racetracks, not racing commissions, racetracks have the right to exclude somebody on their own? And then it comes down to, are they privately owned? Are they state owned, et cetera? You know, maybe Naira cannot, but Churchill can, et cetera. This is the first time I can recall a racing commission telling a racetrack, fairgrounds, that you can't exclude somebody. And I don't know if anybody wants to pursue this. I doubt they will, but I'm not sure that would hold up in court, because, you know, the private property rights of racetracks have been pretty well established for the most part, that if, you know, they could say, Joe Bianco, we don't like your beard, so therefore you're kicked out of fairgrounds. What? You don't like my beard? Well, who cares? We don't like your beard. You know, that's all they need to say. So I don't really know, you know, I don't know if, you know, Broberg did something terrible or didn't do something terrible. That is really kind of uncertain. But now he can race at fairgrounds, which is a big deal for him. And it'll be interesting to see if Churchill will let him back into, he doesn't race as much at Churchill as he does at the fairgrounds. And maybe if he can come back there. But yeah, you know, I thought that was really the most interesting take on this. A racing commission, by and large, telling a racetrack, you cannot exclude somebody. It's up to us. And we're not excluding this guy.
Yeah, it said Broberg pointed out to TDN that CDI did not want to hear his side of the story before issuing the multi-track ban. If the Churchill stewards did not sanction him in any way after explaining what happened when he met with them last month, it kind of sounds like a similar thing to the initial Baffert Naira suspension, where they just kind of ruled him off the grounds without any kind of hearing process or any kind of back and forth or any kind of, you know, attempt to hear his side of the story or hear his evidence. So it is an interesting thing that the racing commission went above the racetrack here. And maybe, you know, Churchill really wants to push it, they can get this overturned. I think my guess is they probably won't, because he's, you know, he's relatively small potatoes. He's not Bob Baffert. He doesn't have a bunch of high profile horses. Yeah, so I just wanted to read the Broberg quote. It's also similar to Bob Baffert. This is the epitome of cancel culture just going crazy. That's the bingo. That's the bingo card right there. The full bingo card is the guy who has all the excuses in the world. When he doesn't have any more excuses, goes to cancel culture, which has ceased to mean anything these days, because now it's just anybody who gets in trouble, usually like a rich white guy who gets in trouble and doesn't have an explanation or any kind of justification. This is cancel culture run amok. Anyway, he says, I can only try to help and I can only try to hope and work to mend the relationship. I mean, obviously, I don't want to poke the bear. I want to be able to get along with everyone. Most racing secretaries love me with the way they get starts per stall. That part of it, that part of the quote was interesting to me because we talked about guys necessarily doing the right thing by the horses. I'm not saying that this was necessarily the case here, are given preferential treatment because they fill stalls and because they fill races. And obviously it's a big, it's a kind of a trade-off because you do not want to have short fields. You do not want to kick guys out that, you know, fill races in an industry where you really do not have big field size, a lot of tracks that really struggle to fill races. So it's a tough, you know, dilemma, tough, like personal dilemma for racing secretaries. But I do think that that is kind of giving the game away a little bit, that he's like, I don't want to ruffle any feathers because tracks love me because I have so many horses. And that is not great when you have trainers that have that much kind of outsized power simply because they have so many horses and simply because they fill races. I wonder what you guys think about that. And you know, whether or not Carl Brober did something bad or illicit in this instance, whether or not you think that there are tracks across the country that are letting him get away with stuff that they shouldn't be because, you know, he's got a ton of horses and he fills races.
Well, I don't know, Joe, if they're letting him get away with anything. I mean, I can't believe a track would know that he's cheating or doing something to totally break the rules and say, oh, who cares? We're going to look the other way. But your point is well taken. A lot of these large outfits, you know, are treated differently. I mean, the guy with three horses should be treated exactly the same as a guy with 150 horses. But we all know that that's not the case. So, I mean, I hope that they don't look the other way if, in fact, they see something. And at least in this sense, you know, it wasn't the racing secretary at Churchill who did this, but it was, you know, the management there. You know, and I know he doesn't run a ton at Churchill, runs more at the fairgrounds, but they, you know, they decided to treat him apparently like anybody else. So, you know, I hope there's not a double standard out there.
Oh, I think there's definitely a double standard out there for certain racetracks, especially. And we can, you know, point to local ones like we've talked about it, like Delaware and Parks. And even what?
Monmouth
and even Mountaineer Park, where there are trainers and there are outfits that are above reproach because they enter horses and they run horses, you know, a number of times every day. They fill stalls, but more importantly, they fill races. And there's no question in my mind that that's the case. That's why I was actually glad to see this jurisdiction stand up and say, you know what, we're not going to accept this. Now, I really think that the crime committed by the quote unquote crime committed by Carl Broberg, his sin was probably a better word, wasn't, you know, that there was a horse that was three-legged lame and on the edge of death and there was nobody watching out for it. I really don't think that was the case based on the information that I've heard. I think his sin was that he's a very outspoken guy and he's a very brash guy, not only in person, but also in social media. And I mean, right down to like, he's got his silks actually say first for sale on the back. You know, I mean, and that like just rubs a lot of people the wrong way. Like you can't imagine how many people are rolling their eyes in Blue Blood Kentucky. Like, oh my God, this guy is so terrible for the industry. And he's so embarrassing. Look, he's so uncouth. He's got for sale on his claiming horses, you know, on his silks because he's a claiming outfit. You know what? The claiming outfits are the ones that make races go and make the card go. So you can't thumb your nose at people like that. But I think that, you know, Carl's big sin was that he's so outspoken about the way that he does things that as soon as the racetrack had the opportunity to kind of nail him on something, even if his protocol, post-race protocol, was the same as the majority of the trainers that are, you know, on that backstretch, it didn't matter. They were going to nail him to the wall because they had an opportunity to do so.
Yeah, that's always funny to me when people get upset about that. The horses are literally for sale.
Yeah,
claiming horses like that. Exactly. That is how the game works. So,
right.
Yeah, I think he kind of says the quiet part out loud in a lot of ways in that stuff. And, you know, people, you know, they like to dress it up and make things seem a little more dignified than they are sometimes in racing. So, yeah, I definitely believe that that's part of it. And that's why Carl Brogberg gets a lot of heat. But I think, you know, there is that other side of it where he's saying basically, they love me because I put so many horses into the entry box. You know, maybe he's getting away with some stuff that he shouldn't be. I don't know for a fact, but I suspect that if not him, there are trainers like that across the country that get that kind of preferential treatment. TDN Writers Room was brought to you by Keeneland. We still get to enjoy a few more days of racing at Keeneland as closing weekend approaches with the Grade 3 Rubicon Valley View Stakes on Friday and the Grade 2 Hagyard Fayette Stakes. I think that's going to be Code of Honor's final start. We might talk about him in a little bit on Saturday, so be sure to tune into that. And as I said, the Keeneland November sale quickly approaching. Book 1 is Wednesday, November 10th. Sale continues through the 19th. A few supplements to Book 1 and the Horses of Racing Age portion of the sale were announced last week, including AZ Warrior, who's a Grade 1 winning daughter of Bernardini. She's in foal to Uncle Mo, already the dam of Irish Stakes winner Key to My Heart. Jazz Tune, who's the dam of Claiborne Breeders' Futurity winner Rattle and Roll. And Look Me Over, who's a half-sister to Grade 1 American Pharaoh winner Corniche. And also, it's Ted Bassett's 100th birthday. Ted Bassett is a Keeneland institution, so happy birthday, Ted Bassett. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
The moment we've all been waiting for is here. Racing returns to Keeneland for the fall meet, October 8th through the 30th. And tickets are now available online for pre-purchase. Place your bets during the fall meet anywhere, anytime from your phone with Keeneland Select. New accounts receive $100 back when you wager $200 on the fall meet, plus the standard $100 sign-up bonus. And Keeneland Select members receive free admission to Keeneland. Sign up to wager at KeenelandSelect.com.
Respect the law. He's earned it. A Grade 1 winning juvenile.
Tis the law. Pops the cork in the champagne.
A classic winning three-year-old.
Tis the law is going to win the first leg of the Triple Crown.
Five triple-digit buyers.
Respect the law. Tis the law.
The best son of Red Hot Sire Constitution.
He's left the others behind. He's going to win the run, Happy Travers.
Tis the law.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Practical Joke has been on a roll over the past few days. Tejano Twist and Deal Me In Bud were both winners at Keeneland for the first crop sire. And on Monday, he added a third stakes winner with She's a Wild Joker in the She's a Stone Cold Box Stakes at Finger Lakes. Source looked pretty good. It's a David Dunk trainee. Other Ashford first crop sires were represented by winners this weekend, including Classic Empire's Old Town Road taking his third straight win for Wesley Ward at Keeneland, and Cupid, who's really coming on now, getting his 11th winner this year with debut winner Cupid's Heart at Belmont. Also, Coolmore Stallions have been well represented through the first two sessions of the Facing October sale. Uncle Mo had a filly fetch $450,000. Mendelssohn had a $400,000 colt, and Justify had two yearlings who sold for $350,000, $325,000. So we've talked about those three a lot. Obviously, Uncle Mo is always super popular, but Mendelssohn and Justify have been extremely popular for first crop sires going through with their horses going through the ring this year at Keeneland September and now at Facing October. We expect that to continue. It'll be interesting to see how their two-year-olds sell next year as well. So Monday, the Jockey Club released its annual report of mares bred for 2021. Usually we get the general number from report of mares bred, which gives us the full crop number, which is always depressing. But this is a little bit more fun to talk about the top stallions and who are the most popular stallions. And there's a new leader, Golden Sense. Golden Sense for Spendthrift was bred to 230 mares. He was bred to 204 in 2020. Super, super underrated stallion. You know, his stud fee was cut from $25,000 to $15,000. And he is one of the best values, I think, in the entire stallion landscape. You know, that's not usually my area of expertise, but I think I can sniff out a good value, you know, when I see one. And he definitely is that. And it looks like the breeders have definitely caught on to that as well. He was a leading third crop sire last year with over $6.6 million in earnings. Got By My Standards, who had a good year. Overall, for the 2021 season, 1,016 stallions covered 27,829 mares. Kentucky's 200 stallions covered 16,727 of those mares, or 60.1% of all the mares reported bred in North America. The number of mares bred to Kentucky stallions increased 2% compared with 16,391 reported last year. Just to fill out the top three, Authentic, which was another Spendthrift stallion, was a close second with 229 mares bred. That was his first book. He stands for $70,000. That's a big number of mares for a pretty substantial fee for a horse who doesn't have at least any track record on the track with progeny yet. So that was a little bit interesting. And then Practical Joke, who I just mentioned in the Coolmore spot, obviously becoming very, very popular, has had a great first year. He rounded out the top three. This is John's area of expertise, so I'm going to toss it to him and see what other observations he had from this report.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. You know, the numbers really were interesting, to say the least. Number one, if you project ahead what the fall crop looks like, if there were, just to keep the math easy, if there were 27,000 mares bred, and you usually figure the rule of thumb is 2/3 of them are going to get in fall. So that makes it really easy. So it sounds like that next year's crop is going to be close to 18,000, which, you know, 18,000 sounds like a big number, but again, it's another drop in potential falls, you know, for the upcoming year. So it is a little concerning in that sense. On the flip side, it was good to see that that some of the states were increasing the number of mares that were being bred in their respective borders. And one of the other things that I thought was really intriguing, actually two things. One is that the top three horses in number of mares bred were all sons of Into Mischief, you know, with Golden Sense 230, Authentic with 229, and Practical Joke with 223. So not only is the Kingpin Into Mischief himself breeding, you know, around 200 mares a year, 214 to be exact, but his sons are now starting to infiltrate the top, you know, matings as well. So you're going to see more and more and more Into Mischiefs in the, you know, that are out there in the gene pool as well. But the other thing that I thought was interesting is the numbers have shifted where in the past it was over 50% of the mares being bred were being bred to proven stallions. This year was one of the first years in a while where the number of mares that were being bred, the majority were being bred to unproven sires. So stallions that have not had a full race even yet. And to me, that is a very commercial shift in the marketplace where people who are breeding commercially would rather breed their mares to the unknown pie in the sky than they would some of the proven stallions that are out there that year in and year out have, you know, tried and true Breeders' Cup, you know, contenders and Derby entries and Oaks contenders. You know, and we've talked about some of these stallions in the past, but it just, it was surprising to me that, you know, you had 229 mare owners that were going to Authentic. And not that he's a bad horse, but just that he's unproven. You just don't know what you're going to get, good or bad. You don't know what those foals are going to look like. And, you know, you have that Practical Joke just started having horses run this year. Vekoma, 222 mares being bred, you know, hasn't had a horse of racing age yet. Omaha Beach, McKinsey, Matoli, Motown, you know, so Audible, the list kind of goes on in the top 10 of unproven stallions. Now, again, that's not a bad thing. It's just an interesting shift in the way breeders think right now that they would rather have kind of an unblemished report of, well, this horse isn't a failure, so he must be huge, high in the, you know, blue sky and high ceilings versus, hey, this horse is proven, but I had a bad one, or I had one that didn't vet, or I had one that didn't, you know, looked like Tarzan and ran like Jane, you know, it was beautiful. So it's interesting that that's the commercial shift now, is that people are willing to take kind of an unblemished look and breed their mares, not knowing what's going to happen, than to breed to something that's tried and true.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely an interesting trend. And, you know, I guess people are just trying to get in on the ground floor. Also, you know, Spendthrift, we talked about this before with the Share the Upside program, and they have special incentives for people to breed to their stallions early on. That could, you know, play a factor in this look, as Vekoma, who you mentioned, stands at Spendthrift as well, and he was fourth on the list. Yeah, I mean, obviously I don't have any horses to breed. I think, you know, Golden Sense makes a lot of sense because of the, you know, the reduced stud fee, because he has so many runners. You know, when you're talking about paying $70,000 for Authentic, yeah, he's a son of Into Mischief. Yeah, he was horse of the year, but I don't know that you can necessarily project that that's great value at this point. I would wait a couple of years at least before I bred to stallions at that level. Nevertheless, there was a couple other notable horses. How about McLean's Music, who went from 57 mares in 2020 all the way into the top 10 this year, and he's fifth place with 221 mares bred. That's a huge jump. I got to think Jackie's Warrior has a lot to do with that.
A lot to do with it. And they doubled the stud fee, Joe. They doubled the stud fee this year. So, yeah, it definitely showed. And that's the the interesting part of the business. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's the interesting part of the business, how is how fickle the market is. You know, what was last year's taboo horse is now this year's top horse. And that's why the breeding game is so hard to figure, because you're breeding your mare. Let's say that you make a decision to breed your mare in 2022. Okay. That mare is not going to fall until 2023, and you're probably not going to sell that horse until 2024. So you're trying to project, you're trying to be Kreskin and project what's going to be the marketplace in 2 years going forward. I think that's part of the reason why people are willing to breed to first year stallions, because the bloom isn't off the rose yet. You know, there's still an unknown out there, and it's still worth, you know, breeding. But some of these horses, I personally love seeing a McLean's Music jump up in stud fee and in popularity, because he throws solid horses. Golden Sense is the same way. Honor Code, who we sponsored the naming contest with, he's another undervalued. Looking at Lucky, I mean, there are a dozen to 15 horses in my estimation that are in that $10,000 to $20,000 range that are tremendous value out there for a lot of these breeders. And it's just a matter of making the conscious decision of, am I going to breed commercially, or am I going to breed genetically and to race and try to help my mare, you know, have a big horse, and then I can go on the more commercial route. And it's an argument that goes back and forth, but this year in particular, it looks like that people are going more and more commercial and unproven.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's for a pursuit that takes, you know, 2, 3, 4 years to figure out whether or not you made the right decision. It's interesting that it's such a fickle market. You know, you would think that something that has that kind of long lifespan of an investment, you would think that people would stick around and, you know, invest in more proven stallions. That's not the case. And you see that with stallions being shipped off before they even really have a chance to have horses run on the track. We saw that with Daredevil. Daredevil somehow fell completely out of favor within what, his first crop of horses on the track, second. And, you know, he was shipped overseas, and now he's back because he had She Dares the Devil and, you know, Swiss Skydiver and a couple other good horses that, you know, it's just, I don't know whether it comes down to there being just too many stallions overall in the landscape, but it's the kind of thing where, you know, people don't want to give stallions time to prove themselves, to give them a year or two to get good sales results. Maybe they give them 1 year on the track to get some good racetrack results. And under yesterday's news, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see where the appetite goes from these first crop stallions getting so much attention here with Authentic and Vekoma. Another one that John didn't mention, another son of Into Mischief, who was the leader among non-Kentucky stallions, was Honest Mischief, who was entered stud this year at Sequel in New York. He was bred to 127 mares. So that's definitely so hot right now, is to get a son of Into Mischief, you know, breed to a son of Into Mischief if you can't get to him yourself. So yeah, it's an interesting shift, like you're saying, to go to these first book stallions. I want to see that appetite continue, where people give the stallions actually a chance to prove themselves before everyone throws in the towel. That's something that I've seen a lot, and that I think doesn't make a lot of sense. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund. Lots of news, as always, with the New York bred She's a Wild Joker, who we mentioned earlier as a stakes winner for Practical Joke, because she took the She's a Stone Cold Fox Stakes as a New York bred. 2-year-old was bred by Three Diamonds Farm, folded Stonegate Stables in Fort Edward, New York, and is owned by Joseph Bucci, who's got a lot of horses in New York. Doing It the Right Way, a 2-year-old son of Super Saver, won the Tin Cup Chalice Stakes at Finger Lakes on Monday, is the 7th winner and the 3rd stakes winner for his stakes winning Damn Revolutionary Act. He's bred by Kindred Racing Stable, folded Hidden Lake Farm in Stillwater, New York, and is owned by Wendy Lee Farm, another big supporter of the New York Bred Program. And John, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about it, because you have some interest in the Breeders' Cup with it.
Well, yeah, we have a New York Bred that's going to be running in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf, named Coinage. And Coinage will be one of the contenders. I don't know if he's going to be the favorite, but he'll be one of the contenders in the race, at least one of the top 12 that'll get in, which we're really looking forward to. And the fact that he's a New York bred, and Joe and Bill, he's a Tappet, actually out of Bar of Gold, who was Medaglia d'Oro Breeders' Cup winner herself. So, you know, it's not just, you know, breeding to race in New York. You get some of these really extraordinarily bred horses that I think, you know, pound for pound are as well bred as their Kentucky cousins. So we're excited about having Coinage in the race. And like I mentioned before, we have two mares in resident mares in New York. And actually, we're trying to decide on which New York stallions to breed to, because this year there's quite a few. And we mentioned before, you know, the Son of Into Mischief that's over at Sequel, and not to mention Central Banker, who's a Spikestown over at McMahon Thoroughbred. So there's a lot of good stallions that are in New York. And we're just shifting through and looking at pedigrees to see how the genetics all line up. But we're excited about Coinage, and hopefully in about a week and a half, I'll be guest of the week actually on the show for winning the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, John needs that hour of text consultation, I think, really badly. But yeah, lots of sons of great stallions populating New York stud farms more and more. So you can really get into some good families on the female side, on the sire side as well. And best of luck to Coinage at the Breeders' Cup. You're going to see some New York Reds run really well at the Breeders' Cup, whether it's Coinage or somebody else. We've got a lot of good New York Reds competing on the top stages, and that is due to the influence of the New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund. So we'll be right back after this message.
Now more than ever, it's time to get with the program, because New York Reds start with an advantage. New York Reds run for serious green at Belmont and Saratoga. New York Bred maidens run for up to $75,000 and allowance horses for up to $85,000. And serious New York Bred owners can collect awards of up to $20,000 per horse per race in open company. So get back with the program. Seriously.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're thrilled to welcome back to the program the COO of First Racing, Aiden Butler. Thank you so much for coming back with us, man.
Guys, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And we wanted to have you for a couple of weeks now because I think you're doing a lot of good things, particularly at Gulfstream, being very proactive and no nonsense. There's a couple of things we want to ask you about that you've done. The first is we had those five trainers that were suspended for clenbuterol violations. And I thought you had some interesting quotes in one of the stories about it. I'm just going to quote you right here.
Yeah.
You said, we did some more this week of testing. This is not a one-off. This is what we're going to starting to do now. Out of competition testing is key. We're basically sick to death of people skirting the rules. We're not going to stand for this. We're pushing extremely hard right now. Anybody that doesn't want to do the right thing is going to face the same treatment. All I can say is, thank God someone says that. Someone in a position of power says that. And everybody loves it. I think everybody is waiting for that kind of honesty. But my question specifically is, why aren't more tracks doing out of competition testing? Is it the expense? Is it they don't have the manpower? Why do you think that this has been a bit of a bugaboo for racing?
Well, I mean, as you're probably aware, it's a really good tried and tested format of catching particularly medication violations well before they become an issue during a race. But we're kind of blessed and cursed in Florida from a state kind of regulatory framework. We're a little bit left in the dark on certain things. The state only steps in certain areas. Just to giving two other examples, the commissions in both California and Maryland do almost all of that at themselves. In Florida, there's not a great deal of out of competition testing done. So I felt rather than waiting for HISA eventually to kick in, rather than waiting, for the state, even with our help, trying to look at different ways of doing this, I figured while we've got these kind of rules that we can implement ourselves more from a house rule basis, we should start to use them. Pretty disappointed in the amount that came back from the first, and these are randomized, so came back was pretty disappointed. Like, I will tell you, and again, I think everyone would love me to give the winners and the losers in this game, but that's not our job. We've done a bunch more testing since and have had a completely zero positive rate. So that's something to be quite quite positive about, no pun intended. But, most people who know me know I'm not everybody's cup of tea because I'm a little bit blunt. I do run out of words eventually to kind of spin things. And when I gave that quote, I feel just as strongly now as I did then. I am sick to death of people not doing it the right way. We've got enough problems in the game. Issues that we're all very, very well aware of as being racing people and working in the industry. And so the silly things like this that are people not either not paying attention or really not giving a crap, just to be blunt again. Ain't going to stand for it. So we're going to keep pushing. But again, a little bit of positivity coming out of the back, because we've continued to do testing and since we've had no issues. So that's great news.
And just to say, that's why we love you.
I left California with a lot more friends than I got now. Put it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, Aiden, thanks for joining us. Kind of staying on a similar subject, there was another kind of messy situation at Gulfstream with this jockey, Carlos Lugo.
Yeah.
Got a 30-day suspension for not persevering with the horse in what was a very obvious betting coup. Have we heard, now the trainer's never been, best of my knowledge, been reprimanded or dealt with. Have we heard the last of this?
You haven't heard the last, I'll put it this way, you haven't heard the last of anybody caught messing around. You haven't heard the last of me basically reacting like I did. This one was great, was handled by the stewards, but we obviously went to the stewards. My background, as you all know, is I was a bookie. So reading races was kind of my shtick. So anyone who is so blatant, first of all, how stupid can you be? All of us see it. Second of all, maybe, you know, in the past, things were maybe a little laxer. They bloody ain't now. So, you know, if people want to keep trying it, great, but it's going to get gradually worse and worse. And if people start to skirt it that much, they are absolutely not going to be welcome at any track I have anything to do with. So it's one of those really disappointing things that people think they can try and get away with that stuff. But I can assure you that you haven't heard the last of any of this stuff. We're going to keep pushing pretty hard on all of it.
That's great. And I think you're making the right kind of enemies. You're talking about how you don't have that many friends. I think you're making the right kind of enemies in racing.
I used to get Christmas cards, though. I think it's going to be a bust this year. I think you might have to put out a poll for me, try and get
We'll get one from the writers' room.
I promise you.
We'll send you a family photo of me, Bill, and John from the writers' room.
Thank you. Thank you.
But so this was another kind of procedural question, because I think, you know, relative to that betting coup, I thought, you know, a lot of people suggested that 30 days wasn't enough for the jockey and some of the fines and punishments weren't enough for the trainer as well. But I know you guys are somewhat hamstrung on that. Can you just explain to the audience where your jurisdiction ends when it comes to doling out punishment and where it goes to the gaming commissions?
Sure. So, and I'll use Florida. Florida is very, very specific because it's different than all the other states. The other states all have their kind of similarities, but Florida is kind of an outlier. What we've done is without having the ability to use the state to come and step in on these issues and kind of push a little bit harder or even put rules forth that, you know, that would deal with this. The clenbuterol rule, every other state's got one. You saw the news came out of New York with bisphosphonates, same in California. So, you know, these sorts of rules are baked in. It doesn't move that quickly in Florida. So one way of getting around that is by putting in a set of house rules. Now, house rules are great because you can really streamline, you know, the speed of rulemaking, and you can also streamline the ability to get new things as they come up, get them into play. There's an issue with that, and that is the issue that is, you know, you guys know as much as anyone, which is fair process. Everybody deserves a fair process, regardless of how we're all so smart and we understand what the industry is, and you know, when somebody's not trying on a horse, it doesn't need a panel of experts, you know, when you know. But there still needs to be a fair process. Now, we are in the process of completely redoing the house rules, making sure that the process does take into account people who have issues, if they want to use the clenbuterol issue, if they want to, you know, challenge it, if they don't believe it was the case. Now, I'll just be a little inside baseball. When a few people, let's say, tried to argue that they didn't think that they had the testing, they wanted to go to more of an argument about protocol of how the hair samples were collected, what was done, I had a really good answer. And that was, no problem, we'll come back to your barn now and I'll test every single one of your horses. And if you're right, I'll write you a really nice apology. Funnily, no one took me up on that. No one took me up on that, which I was quite surprised about. But yeah, all joking aside, we have to, in Florida particularly, make a set of house rules that then the stewards can actually react to. So there is also the rule of, you know, if we believe people are bad actors or we believe people are not doing it the right way, there is a very strong and tried and tested legally trespass rule here where we don't have to have people on private property. But I don't think that does, you know, leaning, going to that extent doesn't do anyone any good. If people are skirting the rules, and or if we're making mistakes, and or if we ever do anything wrong, there needs to be a process. So I'm a big believer in due process and fair process. But in this case, it was I'd kind of had enough. And, you know, if somebody wanted to challenge, that was fine. But I had a solution to that also.
Aiden, switching gears a little bit and on to a more positive
subject. Not positivity.
Yeah.
Is that the show?
Yeah. I imagine that you guys are thrilled with the results of the Tapeta surface, the way it's been accepted by horsemen, the way the racing has been formful, the way it is fulfilling the desire to give the turf course a break. Just give us your take on that.
So I give a lot of credit to the guys on the ground, Billy Badgett, Mike Lakow, the track crew, and then obviously the guys and Joan from Tapeta. It went extremely well. You know, when we put it in, you know, there were a few little snafus, almost all of them created by the pandemic and, you know, supply. And as we're all seeing online, the supply chain across the world is pretty snafu'd, or isn't a snafu, depending which way you look at it. So we started, you know, going through the motions quite a while ago. Billy Badgett, who I'm sure you guys all know, was a big fan of pushing this. We had a bunch of criticism earlier, given a bunch of interviews on this, and a lot of people didn't really see the point of it or didn't see the need to it, but we marched on anyway. And Bill, what you've said is absolutely correct, right? The betting has been really good. We've made some adjustments. It seems you can't get enough water on these things, especially in this climate. Early on, horses weren't closing. It seemed like the front runners had it locked down. That is not the case now. We're getting all sorts of different kind of, you know, closers, early speed. So it's exciting to see that the service is doing what it said on the tin. And I think, you know, I'm happy on a bunch of levels with it, but I'm happy. I think that it shows there is a service, especially the newer ones. I mean, not to forget, we do have a Tapeta service at Golden Gate, and we've run that thing for about a decade now. So older set of technology, still, I mean, really earned its stripes from lasting this long. But the new stuff really is reacting well. And again, I think it's not just a benefit now, but even when the grass comes back, I think there can be a really good set and series of synthetic Tapeta races that we can write. And I've been going back and forth with Billy and Mike Lakow, who's the director of racing out of Gulfstream, to come up with some really novel and interesting types of racing. I don't want it to be when the championship meet starts, I really don't want it to be the place where the cheaper horses go. I don't think that does any of it credit. I think it does it a disservice because it's a very good, consistent, safe racing service. So still plenty to do with it. And looking all over the place where else we can put them. So that it's quite a cool thing to have all three. Don't get me in on the wrong side of all the dirt only guys.
Is there a possibility that a Tapeta course will be put in any other first racing tracks? I would think the best candidate for it would be Laurel.
Yeah, so I think we're going through, and Laurel's a difficult one because there is so much at stake and such a big project plan between the two tracks. But in the last conversation, I think everybody is quite excited at the process of having the three services at Laurel. It's in a winterized climate, you really need something because, you know, it's dirt racing's tough enough at the moment without having just sloppy tracks and no turf. So I really think we should be able to get one in at Laurel. And the next logical conversation would be Santa Anita. Difficult one at Santa Anita just because of the configuration. But we are, and this is no guarantees, but we are in fairly advanced conversations are looking to try and get a synthetic on the training surface there, which I think is great for, and again, no promises, so don't string me up, but no, you know, we do have a hell of a lot of traffic there. There's about 1,800, 1,900 horses rolling around Santa Anita. That's a lot of traffic on a single dirt track. The California way of training is to, you know, get them out and work them a lot more than other places. In other jurisdictions, they run them a lot more than they work them. So I think having that opportunity to have a synthetic track is amazing for the turf horses. And you guys have seen, put in the new chute there to give us the 6 and the 6.5. And then we managed to just get the downhill track back, that downhill turf course back. So really from a turf perspective, we got some really cool moves going on out there. And I think hopefully the icing on the cake would be to try and get a synthetic in at least on the training track.
Gotcha. I want to ask about Santa Anita in a second, but I had a quick follow-up. on the Gulfstream Tapita, because you said something interesting about not wanting it to just be a home for the cheap horses. Mm-hmm. I've heard you guys talk in the past about moving certain races from turf to synthetic, and then maybe certain races from dirt to synthetic.
Yeah.
Do you have any formulations or any ideas about how you might figure that out? Is it determined on field size, quality? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm just going to be, and I'll give you the kind of the high level. We've really got to start to protect the turf a little more at Gulfstream Park. You know, I mean, no one on our side disagrees with that. It's not like there's some random turf guy saying, this mud dust combo that looks green is a good turf course. So we've all been a bit critical of ourselves. But you know, with Calder going away, and with the want to run so many days of racing, we were left with very few options. So we've got the synthetic. I don't know to what extent we will be carding synthetic races that would ordinarily have had a great home on the turf or particularly on the dirt. But I do think there is, once we get through, once the thing gets rolling, I do think there's going to be maybe some decent series, maybe some lower level stakes on there we can do, and even try and take horses that were, I'm using the air quotes, turf specialists, and make them synthetic specialists. It's a home for a lot of these horses year round, or at least a big portion of the year. So it's not a bad thing, but we still, the first thing we had to do, Joe, was get the core, get the track consistent and get it, so we're extremely comfortable with how it's performing. I think we've done that. We're still learning stuff, and the crew out there are learning day by day, but we're really quite happy, as Bill pointed out, that it's performing as it should. So now it's really the exciting stuff. What do we want to do with it? And that all remains to be seen. But there are other conversations that lead this. What about the purse account? What does the purse account look like? If you're really running a side-by-side comparison, synthetic to turf, I still think the turf's going to outhandle it quite a bit. But there are margins there you can play with. And I think it's, I don't want it. I, the only way I can describe it, as I've already said, I just don't want it being this like, they're on the Tapita, it's a cheap service. Certain horses handle it better. There's always an in-between, right? You've got two polar opposites of turf and dirt. And there are certain horses that just react well to it. I've been speaking to Billy Badgett a bunch. And certain horses that, weren't really rock stars anywhere have started to come into their own. So it's a cool thing.
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole thing. Like when there was a synthetic movement, then they got rid of all the synthetic tracks. I think there's a place for all three surfaces, and for horses have a place on all three surfaces. But I wanted to ask about Santa Anita, because I think Santa Anita has been one of the big success stories of the last 2 years, obviously coming from a five-alarm crisis with all the breakdowns in 2019. You guys had a tremendous safety record in 2020. I believe fatalities were cut in half, which is a huge number year to year. I've seen you guys do a lot of reforms. I've seen you institute a lot of training and veterinary reforms. But what do you think, what would you attribute this, decrease in breakdown specifically to? Like, what are the things that you think are working the best?
Yes. Yeah, so it's. I mean, just for, I guess for clarification's sake, if you look at the racing numbers, which is really the only fair metric, if you're going to go, apples to apples across the country, because as you're aware, most racing jurisdictions never list what goes on in training. Because training and other, as we call it, which can be accidents that happen in the barn area, random freaks of nature that can go on, or acts of God, as we call them. But I'll put it down to a change in a little bit of shifting culture. I think everybody out there had such fear, from all the way from the management all the way down to the guys and gals who work on the backside, that we would no longer have a racetrack. And in doing so, no longer have a place where to work out of in some cases, and or worry about what that would mean to the rest of the industry, that it really shook everybody up. I always, I've had a bit of a few crosswords, let's say, with trainers in different jurisdictions about, how they thought that we overreacted in California and what we didn't do. Well, A, the numbers kind of speak for themselves, and B, there's nothing like a local news helicopter hovering over the track every time you have a horse pull up. So that was the reality out there. So what I think that did is that maybe allowed us to push a little harder than we normally would have been able to. And I can tell you, if there's an injury there, and we all know how devastating it is when a horse gets hurt, or a human for that matter, and there's literally a gasp by not the grandstand, by all the trainers. Everybody is upset by it. Everybody is worried. you know, these things, you know, are going to put us all in a bad light, and we need to work better at them. But again, we're in the racing business, and yesterday we had two horses. Thank God they're both okay, but collide into each other in the morning. Random thing, but you're never going to get around that. You know, you have that many animals doing what they do and working and training and being in close proximity to each other, you're going to have a few issues. But if you had to sum it up, it was a combination. The horsemen did their part. The track did their part. You know, the industry as a whole, the California industry as a whole, took it extremely seriously and realized that if we didn't do something, we were going to be in a little bit of trouble out there. So I think, fingers crossed, everybody's still in the same mindset. But nothing's perfect. You know, there are issues all the time, and we just kind of keep fine tuning them. CHRB's done a great job of claiming all the glory, which I'm quite glad that they are. Glad that they were there to help. So yeah, no, it's been a really interesting thing to watch, and I'm super proud of everyone. You know, not to try and sound grandiose, but everybody out there did the bit, and it's not one thing. It's never been the racetrack service. It's never just been the trainers. It's never just been the vets or veterinary practices and protocols. It's a combination, and it's a combination of people wanting to do it the right way and understanding that if you don't, there could be a time, and not too distant in the future, where we're not even able to do this anymore. So that's a surefire way of getting everybody woken up a little.
And I want to switch gears and let's talk about Maryland now. And you guys have had the green light for quite some time to do the rebuild of both Pimlico and Laurel.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot of information has been out there about what the time frames are, which track is going to close at which time, et cetera. Give me your thoughts on, you know, when we might see, the construction equipment show up at one of the other track and get going with this project.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a big undertaking, and ordinarily, I mean, we've done pretty big things, you know, putting in new racetracks. These are all kind of fairly decent sized engineering projects. The difference here is it's being done in partnership, if you will, with the horsemen out there, which adds a different dynamic. And it's also being done via money that's coming, you know, from the state and from the local jurisdictions, which means there are a lot more checks and balances than just, Aiden, Billy and Craig wanting to put a new track in and let's get going, get the permits and we'll start breaking ground. So it's taking a little while to really, you know, iron out all those points, Bill, but I would say that it's progressing fairly well. And I'll give you guys the heads up first when we've got some dates, but all of these questions, as you think them through, do you want to ship Pimlico? Do you want to move everything to Pimlico? Do you want to do Pimlico first? But then what do you do with the Preakness? Because you sure as hell can't move it to Laurel. So you start to get yourself into all of these really interesting conversations that lots and lots of people have a say about. You know, in Maryland is really, we've got a great relationship with stakeholders out there, but it means you do have to be extremely careful. And it's not easy doing it inside the company. So it's a little more difficult doing it with a bigger group, but we're making great strides. And I think the end result, and I'll give Craig Fravel, he don't get enough credit. I'll give him credit for this. He's been out there a bunch and he's been working extremely closely with Maryland Stadium Authority, with the commission, with the horsemen, and with all the different stakeholders that have an interest to get this done the right way. So hats off to him. I've been flying around getting myself into fights with people, it seems. He's been doing some real work.
Yeah, I mean that is God's work at this point. And last question for me, because you mentioned Heisa before. You mentioned not wanting to wait around for Heisa when it comes to some of this drug stuff. We've seen some of the lawsuits that are attempting to stop it or delay it. We kind of just are speculating on whether or not it's going to be instated at its scheduled time, which is next July. What's your sense from the upper levels of the industry as to whether or not this thing is going to be instated on time and whether or not it's going to realistically reform the sport in a, you know, relatively reasonable amount of time?
So if I can go the other way around with those two questions. So I've been, early on when this was first bandied around as an idea, there was a lot of questions about, is it even feasible? How do you implement something like this? But then just, look, if Heisa works as it's intended, I think it's going to be a really good thing to get a singular set of uniform rules, particularly around medication. We've just got to do better as an industry. Now, that said, the big sticker is it works and we're all big supporters. How this thing is going to be funded, what it's going to be, and we're, I'm, I, a little bit, you know, I kind of smile to myself. You know, some of our tracks, we would spend a fortune with, you know, extra veterinary care, extra process, eyes on the track, the best of this, the best of that. And so we're kind of already on that route. So it wouldn't be such a big sea change for us to institute, even if it was the equivalent of, you know, international standards. We're kind of close to that anyway, and that is our intent. But there's a lot of smaller tracks that are going to get a little bit in trouble here. I'm not sure how they're going to keep up unless we can come up with a novel or really a fair concept for funding a lot of these things. But yeah, in California, it's very expensive to, you know, to the industry funds the CHRB. It's a very expensive undertaking to have that many checks and balances on an industry. And that's one of the bigger racetracks in the country. So I'm hoping that they can come up with a funding mechanism, or at least a sensible way of getting this thing funded, so we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and end up with far less racing. But as a concept, I think it's an extremely, extremely smart thing to try and do, to try and get a singular set of rules. Just fingers crossed we can pull it off.
Hey, Aiden, yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. I'm going to wear an Aiden Butler number one fan shirt.
And what you're doing out there. Don't worry yet, because I'm definitely going to need it in about 6 months if you know what I'm up to. So you're going to be the last man standing. Me, you, and a couple of guys in MAGA hats I can get to stand with me still.
Hey, you're fighting the good fight. And we sorely need it, man. We appreciate it. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Aiden Butler will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select The Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made The Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes. All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Owning potential future superstars like Flightline is attainable with a racing partnership with West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So West Point's got some action coming up on Future Stars Friday. They got a couple of juveniles pointing towards the Breeders' Cup. Breeders' Cup is basically here already. It starts next Friday. Giant Game, who broke his maiden at Keeneland by 3 lengths for Dale Romans, is headed towards the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. He's a son of Giants Causeway. It costs $500,000 as a yearling, owned in partnership with Albar Family Stables. We've seen had some good horses with Dale Romans in the past. And Sequist, the daughter of Nyquist, is pointing towards the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. She was a debut winner at Colonial Downs this July and recently placed in the Grade 1 Darley Alcibiades Stakes. So best of luck to West Point and all the partners. We know you guys will be well represented at Del Mar. Have a great time. We'll be rooting for you guys on the racetrack. So there was some appointments news last week. We really don't usually get into the people who are stepping down or getting appointed, but it was interesting that the NTRA named a new president and CEO, was a former congressman named Tom Rooney. He's been named to succeed Alex Waldrop. We heard earlier this year that Alex Waldrop, who was the longtime president and CEO of the NTRA, was going to step down. Rooney is an owner and breeder, has been part of his family's Shamrock Farm, which is a thoroughbred breeding and layup operation in Maryland. The farm was founded by his grandfather, Art Rooney Sr., who, if you're a football fan, you know the Rooney family, you know about Art Rooney, owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers. So, you know, theoretically, the family and Tom have some experience dealing with, you know, kind of large, sometimes unwieldy organizations. I would say I would classify racing in general as one of those, you know, those endeavors that it's sometimes it's hard to manage all the moving parts. it kind of brings up an interesting, you know, discussion, I think, about what the NTRA's role specifically should be. And part of the, you know, also mentioned in the story was that the NTRA is opening a Washington, D.C. office. And I think that that has been the shift in what the NTRA has tasked itself to do, at least in recent years, which is lobbying. Lobbying Congress for horse-friendly legislation. And I think they've actually done a really good job in that regard. They did a good job with HISA. They did a good job, you know, a couple of years ago with changing the tax laws, which was a big deal for horse players, to change the thresholds. So I think that, you know, they're kind of focusing more on what they're doing well. I think there was a time when they were trying to be like a marketing arm of racing, and it just, you know, that's a very hard thing. That's a tough nut to crack in this sport. And, you know, they didn't do a great job, but no one else has really done a great job either. You know, it kind of is something that eludes us as an industry overall. But I that's the interesting part to me, is that they're pretty much kind of devoting their resources to becoming a lobbying arm of the industry. And that, you know, that's definitely a necessary service, because, you know, other than in Kentucky, I don't know that you have a ton of horse friendly or even horse interested legislators in Congress. So I think it definitely helps to have people boots on the ground in DC to help exert what influence we have. And I think it can't hurt to have a former congressman in that role as well. He would presume has connections all across Capitol Hill. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, totally. I'm on the same page with Joe. The Rooney family goes back through football and racing for decades, a very famous family. Tom Rooney's branch of the Rooney family actually owned the Palm Beach Kennel Club in Florida. And so that's where he grew up. And he was a congressman in Florida before stepping down a few years ago. Yeah, Joe, I mean, this means that the NTRA, I mean, they're still doing other things, but this means that they see their main focus, like you said, on lobbying Washington, D.C., and who better to run the ship than a former congressman. Alex Waldrop, by the way, did a very good job, just like you said. Especially, I thought their number one achievement was changing the tax laws on the withholding from the tickets with, it used to be the $600 deal. But he can't possibly have the connections that a former United States congressman had. I'm sure there's a lot of on their agenda that they want to work with. One thing I'm sure that they'll want to do is try to relax the visa situation where, the H-2B-2 visas become so hard to get, and so many farms are having labor shortages. I'm sure that'll be something that'll be on his agenda. I mean, it looks like a really good move on the NTRA's part.
Yeah, and just to quote the release, it says, in conjunction with Rooney's appointment, the NTRA will conduct a strategic review of the organization and its activities as it places additional focus on its role as the trade association for the thoroughbred racing and breeding industry. So they're telling you right there that's what they think their key role is going forward. And just to build on Bill's point, if you don't know, we're talking about the change in the tax law. This was a major, major deal for American horse players. It used to be that if you hit a ticket that was $600 or up, you would have to report that to the IRS regardless of how much the ticket actually cost. It was this arcane tax rule that was in place when there were really no exotic forms of exotic wagering. And they were, you know, the rule, and this lines up with other forms of gambling, the rule is like 300-1 or better, you have to report it to the government. But the problem was that they were figuring that based on the base amount of the wager, which was a lot of times 50 cents or a dollar. And they weren't figuring it based on the total cost of the ticket. So that was the issue, is that you could play a 50-cent pick five and it cost you $1,000 because you have 2,000 combinations. If it hit and paid $600, you had to report that to the government, even though you lost $400, because the government was looking at it as a 50-cent ticket rather than a $1,000 ticket. Same thing, there was a $5,000 withholding threshold, where if you hit anything for $5,000 or up, they automatically took 25% out, regardless of what the ticket cost. It was about the base amount. So that was a huge deal. And that was not easy, because they had to explain basically to the tax regulators what was happening. And a lot of people from the thoroughbred industry chimed in as well. A lot of horse players, I wrote comments on it. But that was something that was not necessarily an automatic common sense thing to be changed in the tax law. That took a lot of work and a lot of education from the NTRA. So I think they really have done a good job in that way. And Bill mentioned the H-2B visas as well. I think that they've done a lot of pushing on that subject. And it's definitely something that's crucial to the industry and crucial to horsemen to be able to have help. And I think, honestly, this new administration has helped in that way by relaxing. There was a release like a week or two ago that said these you know, mass immigration raids at work sites are going to stop now. So that, I think that, you know, gives people a little bit of a breath of relief that they don't have to worry about, you know, the ICE coming and banging down their door on the backstretch, which was always a ridiculous thing to do to begin with. But yeah, so the NTRA has done a lot of good work on this kind of stuff, and I appreciate them, I think, refocusing on that entirely. We're still trying to figure out like the marketing aspect of racing, but the NTRA has definitely done good work. And I think that refocusing as a Congress oriented organization and a lobbying oriented organization makes complete sense. It'll be interesting to see what kind of new initiatives and what kind of new stuff they try to push with the appointment of Tom Rooney. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy is currently selling at the Facing Tip in October sale. They'll be at Barn 22 through Thursday, so be sure to stop by. They'll also be on site next month at the Facing Tipton and Keeneland November breeding stock sale. So best of luck to them in this busy season. And Legacy will be represented in the Breeders' Cup by Ain't Easy in the Juvenile Fillies. Daughter of Into Mischief was a $400,000 Legacy grad last year's Keeneland September sale. As we remember, was a very impressive winner of the Chandelier Stakes at Santa Anita. So best of luck to Ain't Easy and her connections and to everyone at Legacy in getting through this sale season. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. A reminder, it's still a couple days left in the Keeneland Fall Meet. It runs through Saturday, and we got the Keeneland November sale starting November 10th. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Aiden Butler, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. See you next week.